Neoclassical economists have two concepts that they love to bring out all the time. The first is the notion of public goods, that is a commodity or service that is provided without profit to all members of society, either by the government or by a private individual or organization. The second and related notion is the idea of market failure, which is when, for whatever reason, the incentives of the individual players of the market do not converge to produce net benefits for the whole. The reason that these two concepts are related is because public goods are often said to be exactly those sorts of goods that the market fails to provide. Now, as someone who leans much more towards the teachings of the Austrian School of Economics, I am somewhat dubious about these claims. In this video, I am going to lay out my arguments for doubting both market failure and public goods as valid concepts, and why they are not at all part of my own thinking. One reason for making this video is that recently I got into a debate with other people who are very interested in economics about exactly this topic. This is not a left versus right issue. Everyone in this debate was very pro-market. In fact, there are staunchly free market people from the Chicago School who maintain that market failure and public goods are both valid concepts. For example, here is David Friedman, the son of Milton Friedman, who maintains that they are valid concepts. Friedman is no socialist. He is literally an anarcho-capitalist. And remember, viewers, no matter what rumors people tell you, I am not one of those. So let's hear what he has to say.
So what is market failure? Market failure describes situations where individually rational action does not produce group rational action. In the extreme case, each person correctly does what's in his own interest, and we're all worse off as a result. The reason it happens is that I'm taking an action which benefits me but hurts you. I act in terms of my cost and benefits, not yours. You are doing the same thing in the other direction. And my favorite example is an imaginary situation about 1,000 years ago, where we are part of a line of 10,000 men with spears. We're all facing in that direction. Sorry, let me get my hand up where you can see it. And the reason we're doing it is that in that direction there are 10,000 more men, only they're on horseback, and they have spears too, and they're coming at us. And so I do a very, very quick cost-benefit calculation. I say, if all of us stand and we hold our spears solidly, with luck we can stop their charge. And if we stop their charge, some of us will die, but some of us will live. If we try to run away, horses run faster than we do. So I should stay. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control the people on each side of me. If I stand and everybody else runs, I'm dead. If everybody else runs, my only chance is to run faster. On the other hand, if I run and everybody else stands, I'm only one man out of 10,000. The chances that we'll stop their charge are almost as good without me as with me. And if I run, I won't be one of the ones killed. So I correctly calculate that I'm better off running. Everybody else in the army makes the same calculation. We all run and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right, that's a case where my decision to run helps me and hurts everybody else. Everyone else is in the same situation. We all correctly figure our self-interest, and the result is an unattractive result. A more mundane example, which I used to observe when I was teaching at UCLA, there was an intersection south of the University of California in Los Angeles, which the locals claimed was the busiest intersection in the world. I don't know if it's true. But you could see each day that when the light was about to go red, cars going one way would pull into the intersection trying to get across. Light goes red, the intersection is jammed in that direction. Cars can't go the other way. Eventually, the intersection empties just in time for cars coming the other way to jam the intersection that time when the light goes red. So if everybody had politely waited to pull into the intersection until he was sure that he could get across, everybody would get home faster. but each person is better off doing what he's doing. For a still more familiar example, which I suspect you've all experienced, it is frustrating to be in a restaurant or a bar and not be able to hear anyone because everybody is talking too loudly. Why is everybody talking too loudly? Because at the initial level of sound, if I want to be heard, I have to speak a little louder. So then if you want to be heard, you have to speak a little louder. And you end up with everybody speaking like this instead of speaking like this in a reasonable voice. All right?
Now, I find it telling that in his three examples, none of them are really market problems. The first one, with the spears, is a zero-sum situation featuring the use of force, that is, it is a war situation, which is defined explicitly by being force and not trade for mutual benefit. The other two situations, that is, driving and obeying the rules of the road and talking in a restaurant, are also not, strictly speaking, issues of market transaction. There's no trade taking place in either of these situations. Obviously, you pay for the meal in the restaurant and, I guess, for your seat, but not necessarily for talking to your friend. Friedman goes on to use three more examples in this video, which I want to analyze further. I think they're more interesting. The first is the alleged public good of listening to the radio, which people don't typically pay for. The second is the alleged public good of the lighthouse. And the third is the problem of the fact that a bunch of farmers, who as a group might benefit from building a dam, for whatever reason, individually do not wish to invest in this dam, and so the public good that would come from building the dam goes unrealized. Classic case, apparently, of market failure. Okay, so let's think about this radio listener first. Is it really true that she pays no cost for her pleasure of listening to this radio station? It is true that she pays no money, but that does not mean that she does not pay at all. She is paying for the pleasure with her time. This woman pays an opportunity cost for her choice to listen to the radio, as opposed to, say, playing on a video game, reading a book, talking on the phone to her friend, going shopping, or any number of other things that she could be doing. Yes, I realize that it is theoretically possible to, let's say, listen to the radio while playing a game or something like this, but the principle remains unchanged. She has to give up her undivided attention to any one of these things in order to enjoy the full pleasure of listening to the radio show. And so the market transaction here, although it has no physical resources attached to it, is that the woman gives the radio station her time, and the radio station gives her entertainment in return. In fact, this transaction is multiplied many times over by every single listener who is tuning in to this radio show. There are no free riders because every single listener pays an opportunity cost with their time. And it is precisely this time that the listeners are giving up to the radio station that represents value for a potential advertiser. The advertiser seeks to give money in exchange for a portion of the time that the listeners have devoted to this station. If you doubt that listener time is the real commodity that the advertiser is paying for, then imagine that there is a second radio station with far fewer listeners and you are an advertiser with a limited budget. All else being equal, do you advertise with the radio station with the greater number of listeners or the one with the smaller number of listeners? The choice seems very straightforward. The more listeners who trade their time for pleasure, the greater the value of the radio station to the advertiser. There is no market failure here, and this is not a public good. Next, let's think about this lighthouse. So the neoclassical theory goes, the incentives of the locals to pay for this lighthouse on the market are low because it is too easy for ships to free ride in the public good of its light. Too many people wouldn't pay. Ergo, the government should step in and build the lighthouse from taxpayer money. Now let's think about this. Who are the greatest net beneficiaries of the lighthouse? I think that there are two chief groups. The first are the local merchants on the ground, And the second are the incoming traders bringing in their ships from the seas. The merchant has a vested interest in the trader coming to shore to bring the vital goods he needs to stock his wares. The trader naturally has a vested interest to sell said wares, and of course these transactions wouldn't take place if the trader was dead, because the lighthouse wasn't there and he'd crashed into the rock. So there are two possible ways of funding this lighthouse. The first is for the local merchants to fund it directly. However, I think this does not overcome the possible free rider problem, because some merchants may not pay and therefore they'd be getting their incoming trades at a reduced cost. The much better solution is the second one, which is that the docking trader pays at the gate when he anchors his ship before he can unload his cargo. This is a mandatory toll that is then used to fund the lighthouse. Ultimately, of course, the local merchant is the one who is really paying for this, because no doubt the trader will embed some part of this cost in his price, which he then charges to the merchant for the incoming goods. And so there can be zero free riders here, because every sea trader, and therefore implicitly every local merchant, pays. But aha, agent, I have you now. What about the pirate who tries to sneak into the lights of the lighthouse in order to smuggle his stolen booty? Well, I would argue that in this case, the pirate is simply breaking the law and should be arrested as soon as he tries to dock. Crime is not evidence of market failure. It is a law and order issue, which is outside the scope of funding a lighthouse. And now, what about this dam and these farmers? Let's pretend an entrepreneur has seen that this place would benefit from a dam. There are five farmers who need to invest into that dam, or it will not be built. He pitches them all together, and let's pretend that in this scenario they all invest, and here the dam is built and everybody is happy. And now let's go through another scenario. This time he pitches the farmers one by one, and each of them, when they mull over the proposal, think that they'd be better off saving their money. I mean, there are other farmers. They might fund this dam, but I'd prefer to spend my money on something else. Well, farmer one, he decides he'll invest, but farmer two, he's out. Farmer three, he's out too. Farmer four, well, he'll invest, but farmer five, he's out. So the entrepreneur does not get the required buy-in from the farmers, and the dam is not built. For certain members of the Chicago School, this failure to build the dam is an example of market failure. I would like to suggest that this is nonsense. Every single farmer was given the option to invest. He weighed up the pros and the cons and decided that he'd prefer not to invest. Now, that could be a good entrepreneurial decision or a bad entrepreneurial decision by the farmer. Only time will tell. But the fact remains that the revealed preference of the market on this occasion is that there should be no dam. I'll put it another way. There was not enough demand for the dam. The individual preferences of these farmers, as revealed in their investment decisions, is that there should be no dam, and so the dam is not built. From my way of thinking, this is not market failure, but it is the market working exactly as it should. When certain economists argue that this is market failure, they are simply propagandizing for the special interests of the entrepreneur who failed to get his dam built. Or even worse, they are making an a priori value judgment that a dam is better than no dam. In other words, their individual preference is for there to be a dam, and because the market didn't build what they wanted, something must have failed. There's a name for this: the vision of the anointed. The market didn't conform to my tastes, and therefore something must have gone wrong. Market failure, then, is just a rather sophisticated form of special pleading. It is rather like a film critic lamenting the fact that Citizen Kane, a film that he considers to be the best of all time, was a box office flop. Well, that's market failure. Just as the public prefer to spend billions of dollars on watching Transformers rather than on the latest arthouse fare favoured by the elites, so the farmers preferred to spend their resources on things other than the dam favoured by our failed entrepreneur dam visionary and the economists who back his anointed vision. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, the Crimson Satyr, the Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyotomi Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darrow.